that these professed beliefs, or in other words, conventional religion, is not very operative in life, that is, in the value system of Americans. Now, this we already touched upon last Tuesday. I want to develop this point because it's so important. And this arises a big problem. The evidence for this is massive and accumulated. I'll just list three types of evidence. A discrepancy between the value system of Americans and the operative value system of Americans and the professed religious beliefs or professed religion. You remember I indicated the startling fact that when Americans are asked, these Americans, 90% say that this is a very important thing. They're asked, would you say your religious beliefs have any effect on your ideas of politics and business? And ideas of politics and business, of course, constitute the value system for much of the life of the male population. The answer is 54% say no. Now, obviously, a tendency would be to say yes or not. You just there is a kind of skepticism about saying yes. Nevertheless, 54% said no. Now, this gave the poll taker a very considerable joke that they repeated this in various contexts about the same facts. 54% of Americans say that their religious beliefs have no effect on their ideas of politics and business. Now, something must have an effect on their ideas of politics and business. There must be some context out of which their ideas of politics and business do emerge, you see. According to their own avowal, it is not their religious beliefs. We have reached just a this year, beginning of a more formal study of the effect of beliefs of their religious belief. There's an essay or a paper in Sociometry, one of the sociological journals, by Russell Middleton of Florida State and Snell Putney of San Jose State College. You'll see why they collaborated, one from Florida, the other from California. They want to test a thesis which was put forward by Robert Merton, but they quote, especially my thesis here, Herbert contends that the United States, quotes, both the religionists and the secularists, cherish the same basic values and organize their lives on the same fundamental assumptions, values and assumptions defined by the American way of life. And that's what they want to test. They took 260 male and 294 female college students, enrolled in social science classes at two states, one institution, one in Florida, the other in California. This gave them a kind of cross-country reference. Classed them in the values in rather simple mind four, but for our purposes not useless. They classified actions as whether anti-ascetic or anti-social. Anti-aesthetic actions include gambling for money or sports events, gambling for money at cards or dice, smoking, non-marital heavy petty, non-marital sexual intercourse, intentionally looking at pornographic pictures, and drinking alcoholic beverages except for religious purposes. Anti-social based actions they put include shoplifting and essentially taking something from a store without paying for it, stealing cars, schools, and other items from hotels, hotel investments, striking another person in anger, except self-defense, lying to a teacher concerning reasons for missing class, a failure to complete assignment, theft, prevent the video, cheating on examination, deliberately placing unjust blame on another person for something that was really was up for. So, you see the classification. It's a simple classification, it's not very precise, but it's used for our purposes. Now, what do they find? The results are pretty unequivocal. Here are what the results are. They exclude for the violence of believers and non-believers. Again, only the avowal was used themselves. They also made a check, what they called a dualistic conformity. They found a pretty close relation between believers, people who said they're believers, and their church attendance on Hammurabi, and the non-believers with their non-church attendance, roughly. So they're pretty good classification of our purpose. Believers, they found, are more likely than non-believers to regard anti-ascetic actions as wrong, and they are less likely than non-believers to engage in them. This is the only significant difference we find between the two groups. They do not differ in how often they believe antisocial actions are wrong, or in how likely they are to engage in them. Nor do they differ in the frequency with which they violate their own standards, ascetic or social, by engaging in actions which they themselves regard as wrong. Conclusion. With regard to antisocial actions, there is little or no apparent difference between the religious and the irreligious in either normative standards, in either normative standards or behavior, that is, what they believe, we like, what they do. Our data tend to support suggestions by Merton and Herber that the religious and the non-religious in our society share the same basic social values and are about equally likely to live up to them. Now, this really confirms what the observers have been asserting all along. This is a sample of the kind of evidence that is now beginning to accumulate. You see, this kind of evidence will never be sought for until someone puts forward a thesis which has been tested, a hypothesis which has been tested. It's only because they have been forward that some sociologists are now trying to find out what the evidence. What the evidence will say about this hypothesis. Therefore, this material is just beginning to be gathered, you see. There is also an older survey which has been renewed, the celebrated Ladies' Home Journal called On Religion, which was in first in 1948, was repeated in 1958. And there's all kinds of things different. The question there is, look within yourselves and state honestly whether you think you really obey the law of love. And then they gave five different cases there. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. In the case of a person of another religion. In the case of a person of another race. In the case of a business competitor. In the case of a communist or fascist, Nazis. In the case of an enemy of the nation at war. Now, the figures, I'll take the yes figures. Look within yourselves and say honestly whether you think you really obey the law of love. In the case of a person of another religion, 95% of Americans said yes. Now, you remember, this represents the conviction of Americans about themselves. It does not represent. It's not a reliable guide for their behavior. But it's important to know what Americans believe about themselves, you see. In the case of a person of another race, 80%. In the case of a business competitor, 78%. In the case of a communist or a Nazi, 27%. In the case of an enemy of the nation, 25%. Now, there's obviously a sharp gulf here. There are three kinds of situations which Americans believe that they follow the law of love pretty much all along the line. And two cases in which they themselves believe they do not follow the law of love. The three cases are another man, another person, another religion, of another race, and a physical method. There, in varying degrees, they believe they obey the law of love all along the line, see? But in two cases, they don't. In the case of a communist or a Nazi, in the case of every other nation, they're only a quarter say they obey the law of love. Now again, remember what I'm saying here. This is what Americans believe about themselves. These figures reflect not so much the actual behavior of the American people. No people on earth ever love their neighbors as much as American people say they do. But it reflects how seriously Americans take transgressions of the law of love in various cases. In other words, in the more reputable vocabulary, whom do Americans regard their neighbor? Really regard their neighbor, you see. You see the point here? Americans feel they ought to love their fellow man. That's really what we're talking about. Americans feel they ought to love their neighbor, their fellow Americans. This is all about Americans. Despite differences of race or creed or business interest. But they don't feel that they ought to love their neighbor. This has nothing to do with actual conflict, but even though they feel they ought to love their business competitor, this does not apply to not being competition. There's no connection there, there's not intended to be any connection. But they do not feel they ought to love a communist or a Nazi or enemy of the nation. Now, the Lincoln Barnett, who conducted this poll, noticed very clearly, and noticed very struck with this fact, that according to the Christian law of love, there ought to be no discrepancy along the line. You see? Especially love your enemy, remember? Which does not mean don't resist your enemy. Love your enemy. And yet he noticed this sharp double. Three quarters of Americans, 80% of Americans, or better, believe they ought to love all along the line a person of another religion, of another race, of this competitor. Only 25% of Americans believe they ought to love a communist or a Nazi or an enemy of the nation. He didn't pursue this. He noted the discrepancy between the professed, between the avowals of Americans, sincere avowals of Americans, and the professed beliefs, you see. The professed religion. But he didn't ask the question, in terms of what system of values will this make sense? Now, notice it isn't as simple as it seems. Americans will assert they ought to love their neighbor in situations in which the actual conflict is very severe, for instance, business competitors. And in the case of a conflict or a Nazi or an enemy of the nation, this is pretty remote. The great bulk of Americans have never seen a communist or a Nazi. Never seen one. It's pretty remote. So it isn't a matter of passion involvement or anything.
Wasn't the question stated so that if they were honest with themselves, did they find themselves loving that person or not, and not in terms of whether they ought to?
Well, I know, but yes, it was stated as you said. But we know we shouldn't take their avowals as a competent guide to their behavior. Every sociologist knows that people will give a sincere, honest answer to these questions. But while they're not trying to deceive the poll taker, they're deceiving themselves. That's all you have to tell anybody. When more than 50% of Americans say that they attend church every week, does anybody really believe that? You can make a calculation about it. Religious activists in this country would call them. They believe they're doing this, you see. Oh, maybe. Of course, I missed one question. But I'm not sure.
Well, the question was stated, ought I to love the enemy of the nation? I wonder if the percentages wouldn't be somewhat higher than rather than
no. Well, I hope that I would be deceptive, you see. That would be deceptive. Then they would answer like a Catholic, say, what is the Catholic? I don't answer that according to the catechism. You see? Now notice, these figures are exalted, as I said in the first three figures. 95% of Americans don't obey the law of love. In relation to anybody. Certainly not in relation to the people of another religion. Do you believe that they do? Anybody can believe they do. And 80% don't obey the law of love all the way in connection with the person of another race. And 78% don't obey the law of love all the way to the connection of business competitor. But they think they ought to. And therefore they see something believing they do. But when it comes to a communist or a Nazi or a enemy of the nation, they don't think they ought to. That's all. And therefore they make an honest statement there. Very few do. Less than about four. Now, the discrepancy is obvious, but the more important question is this simply incoherent idiocy, you know? Or is there a belief system for which this makes sense? That's a big question. You see what I'm going here?
On these last two categories, it seems as though there really is a question in my mind as to whether the church is acting canonically
what is tradition about that. Well, some churches have, some churches haven't. It's not likely that they learned about the law of love from the church. But in any case, that will always push the problem further back. If the churches did it, in terms of what system of values there, then the church began discrimination, don't you see?
Don't you think this term love in a sense is ambiguous? Because they may think they ought to love their business competitors, that implies a certain mode of behavior, being friendly, so on and so forth.
That's right.
But they might confuse, well, should I love the enemy of the nation, say, of war? Well, shooting doesn't seem to be an act of love.
Well, that's the whole question. How about a member of a communist or a Nazi, the same thing? That's the whole question.
Well, you were trying to say that it seemed like to me that this didn't imply necessarily the kind of actions they took for these people.
It does not imply the kind of actions.
Well, they might give that impression of the attitude of these other two categories that this is what is involved.
Of course they think it implies, of course they think that it implies their actions. But we don't have to believe that. They sincerely believe this. And the question, you remember the question that a minute ago? Friendliness, geniality, whatever, they think they ought to feel that in relation to members of another religion, whereas we know they don't, not 90% of them do, right? A person of another race, whereas we know they don't, not 80% of them do. And business competitors, and I think that's the most startling, certainly 70% of them don't actually have these friendly, amiable, genial relations with business competitors. Yeah, I believe they all have it. And they would feel guilty if they didn't. Let's put it another way.
It seems like you're implying that the Christian position for these people think is obviously that one of the pastors. This is what
they're one of the wildfire. I didn't hear.
That they should, that the Christian position that is being portrayed and being represented in the poll is one of being a pastor.
No. Well, I just said a minute ago, a gospel point South Africa, love your enemy yet kill him.
Well, that makes clear. Oh,
it makes no difference here. Because they have exactly the same attitude. You can love, you want to be your business competitor, you want to go out of business, don't you? Bankrupt them. And yet they all want to. Don't you realize it makes no difference? The question is, what do you feel guilty about? Do you feel guilty about what? You feel guilty about not loving, whatever love means, people of another religion, people of another race, your business competitor. Even though you put the business competitor out of business, and you're just trying to do that. You're trying to bankrupt it. And yet they don't feel guilty about whatever love is in relation to a communist or a Nazi, in relation to an enemy of a nation. That's all I'm saying. Now, their avowals ran in line with the Christian teaching on this, they would have to say the same thing about all of them, and obviously violate all of them with the same frequency. You see? As a matter of fact, another poll like this was taken in West Germany and in Britain and showed quite different results. In any case, the question here is what they feel guilty about, you see? And when they feel guilty about something, they will not avow it. If you anticipate it, are the professed beliefs of Americans to the Bible. To the Bible. You go right in 1 Peter, Romans, and go with him. It's not the difference. He gets that there is a value system. There must be a value system. This is a matter of public phenomena. They tell me which this makes sense. That's our question. This poses a problem. It doesn't answer anything. It poses a problem. Exactly the same as Middleton and Putney. You see? I'm anti-social actions, according to Middleton and Putney. Believers and non-believers express and feel guilty about saying things. In the same way. Without any discernible difference. And finally, their own standard about saying things as frequently. You see? For it cannot be their professed belief, which is the context of their values. So let me say, well, then, that's all. Let me see the simple methodological problem here. And difference to make it, to be a difference, to make a difference, you know. Obviously, in these areas, there are things where these don't make that difference, you see. What does make a difference? You see, isn't the problem now? Now, the problem is, what are the actual belief system? That is, what the sociologists call the operative religion of Americans. This is what I'm getting at. So, you have to make a distinction, both for the individual and the culture, between conventional religion, or professed religion, and operative religion. The religion that actually operates in the culture. Now, every culture must have an operative religion. Robin Williams, in the one of the sociologists, in his book on American Society, puts it this way. Every functioning society has, to an important degree, a common religion. The possession of a common set of ideas, rituals, and symbols supplies an overarching sense of unity, even in society riddled with conflicts. A common religion is a functional prerequisite in any society. Society wouldn't exist without a common religion in this sense. A common set of ideas, rituals, and symbols, you see? It just couldn't exist otherwise. That is operative religion. Now, there are cases in history where the operative religion is open, or the professed religion, or rather the professed religion is the operative religion. By now, there are such cases. But in America today, it is not the case. This is the mark of secularization. The gap between conventional religion, professed religion, and operative religion is a mark or a measure of secularization. You see that one here? Is that clear or is it? Unintelligible.
Well, do you want to?
Yes. All right. Now, you know how to profess religions. The religion people profess, and it generally has conventional religious names like Protestantism, Catholicism, Judaism, Methodism, or something like that. And it generally has names that are used ordinarily regarded as religious names. Not always, but generally. Now, the sociologist speaks of the common religion of a culture. Common set of ideas, or you want to be ideals, values. I'll add one word. Ideas, values, rituals, and symbols, which supplies an overarching sense of unity to the society riddled with conflict. All sides riddled with conflict. That's operative religion. Is that clear? That's the belief system that holds society together. That's weird, isn't it? Now, it is conceivable that there have been some societies in which the professed religion also was operative. It was the religion that helps the society together. In America today, this is not the case. That's what I've been saying. There's a gap between, and a difference, a large difference between the professed religion and the operative religion. They're not the same. When the operative religion, professed religion, not religion, are not the same, you have secularization. The gap between them is the measure of secularization, you see? Is that clear now? Secularization means the ordination of the culture to values that are not content. pain in the professional living, don't you see? Or the pain are only overlapping, we can say. But that, we'll discuss that later in another case. You see my point here? And our problem now is, what is the operative religion of Americans? In other words, and that would be a system in which the Ladies' Home Journal poll would make sense, in which Middleton and Putney's results would make sense. It would make sense that 54% of Americans, who 90% or more, think religion is a very important thing, yet don't believe that their religious, and yet about their religious beliefs have no effect on their views in politics or business. Now, I'm proceeding slowly, but I want this to be absorbed. Follow what I'm saying? Is there any question? Now we have a problem. How do we interpret what our religion is? Well, if we were anthropologists and were living in a primitive community, everything is strange to us, we have less difficulty than sociologists living in America. You understand? Anthropologists in a primitive community know more about the religion of that community, the religion of the community, than its natives themselves. Well, we need some operational definitions of operative religion, some technique by which we can discover what the operative religion of an individual or culture is. And Robert Williams has took my hearing. And I think we generally agree. What would you suggest? How do we know what operative religion is? You meet a person. You ask him what is his religion. You're sophisticated enough to know that one professor is not always one doctor of religion. How do you find out doctor of religion? Mistreating a member of another religion. They will not justify it. They will restrain them all right, but won't justify it. They won't justify it. They feel guilty about it. 80% will not justify mistreating a member of another race. They'll mistreat them all right, but they won't justify it. They'll feel guilty about it. They're not pointing out the American Amendment. And 78%, let's say 80%, will not justify mistreating a business competitor. As I said, they'll mistreat it, but they won't justify it. They'll feel guilty about it. About 75% of Americans feel quite will not be guilty about mistreating an enemy of the nation. Whatever mistreating means, the same right here all along the line. Whatever they think of love is the same thing all along the line. But that now rather than just this first criteria, differences in religion make a difference. In such standards of competency. We'll see in a moment now how this operates. But the second criteria, I think, is even better, it's quicker. Men are always likely to be most intolerant of opposition to their central ultimate values. What you really believe in, if you want to know what you really believe in, see what you're intolerant about. That's one of the best operating criteria. Men are always likely to be most intolerant of opposition to their central ultimate values. You feel the shit for? In fact, that's a very good test. Find out what people flare up at. Not entirely their operative values, don't you see? Isn't that very clear, isn't it? And that's a very useful criteria. Now, any question on this? Differences in religion make a difference in social standards and social standards and conduct. Any question now on this? Now, yes, go ahead.
It doesn't seem to me like that would be too.
That would be what?
It doesn't seem to me like that would be too sure. First, flare it up at a time when they're trying to justify themselves. I mean, they feel guilty about nothing, and
well, not
an attack. So you might think it's their central ultimate value, but really it'll be something they're trying to.
Well, that's exactly the point. The flaring up and justification and guilt go together. They're highly correlated. There's two different criteria which are highly correlated. That's all, they go together. A person will flare up about things, about a value, which if he violates, he will feel guilty about and not just about it. The two go together. Now, I'm going to say this in a moment for Americans. Now, our question is here, what is the common religion of American society? That is, what is the system of belief, out of which the operative value system of Americans emerges? In other words, what do they feel, system makes a difference in their moral standards and behavior? Another way of putting it is, what are they most intolerant of? Now, if we examine Americans from this point of view, we find curious things. Americans are very intolerant about certain things which are professedly religious. Which are those things?
Yes, there
one.
I didn't get the question.
Americans are empowered, flare up. By empowered means flare up. And that's what I mean by empowered, flare.
They,
with that heat, flare up. About certain things which are professionally religious, certain beliefs or things that are professionally religious. Now, I want to be honest, what are those?
Well, an example would be the one.
So, for this, that's being.
The only religion. Well, some do, some don't. That's right. Unbelief in God. Atheism. Unbelief. Or that curious word that no Americans ever heard of, agnosticism. Unbelief in God, they flare up there and think about it. Now, we have undeniable evidence. About 85% of American people say they would not employ an atheist as a teacher of anything in public schools or in any public capacity whatsoever. We have not the slightest doubt about that. There's something else, too, which is not so obvious. Something, another religious thing. Most Americans are very touchy, very flare up against it, and are in very common. Well,
yes, absolutism.
No, no, some do, some don't. But I think you're right, that's more subtle though. And let's, we probably could add this to add it on later, but there's another 2 point, which is.
If you were to try and show that there was any difference between God and the nation or our way of life, or.
Well, yes, but that's a religious thing, you see. I'm thinking of professing religious beliefs. I love a low valuation or a contempt for religion. You see? When anyone shows a contempt for religion, that is great on America, then they flare up. And we have to absolutely think under a religion. In other words, in the system of values Americans have, there are at least two religious things. There are more, but at least two religious things. Belief in God and the value of religion. But there are many things that Americans behave about in exactly the same way. They're not religious at all. Take, for example, the most startling one, sanitation and cleanliness. Now, try to look at this seriously. America visits Spain, or the Middle East will take Spain, it's a Western country, and it doesn't. And they generally, while they like everything about Spain, they feel a rising board at three things. First, Spain doesn't have our kind of democracy. Secondly, there is a low value of a place on popular education. Not high education, but popular education. And third, that there's no sanitation companies outside of the American hotels. Not the sanitation plan of the point of America. Now, these, I'm going to discuss the first two later on, but let's take sanitation and cleanliness. Americans feel the same kind of indignation about this they feel about anyone who denies God. That is a moral question. This is an argument. I'm taking this because I have an application. What kind of people are these? In other words, they're degenerates. They must be immoral, you see? Now, no one maintains, well, I wouldn't say no one, because there is a maxim, you know. No one will seriously maintain that sanitation and cleanliness comes to a religious thing the way belief in God does. Although we have the formula, cleanliness is next to godliness, you remember? Where does it arise? Not in early Christianity. Not even in our place, but in England. Which our view is continuous, you see? Which our view is continuous. On the contrary, right from Christian history and pagan history, cleanliness was regarded as ungodliness, or at least a strict of ungodliness, luxury. And the early Christians, and not early Christians, but the contemporary popular preachers, generally the cynic persuasion, or the stoic persuasion, some of the religious, and made a point not to be clean. I mean to crawl and burn. Because otherwise they could be regarded as hypocrites. Here they are thinking of heavenly things and what they do, they care of their bodies. And Julius, the apostle, got out of the country, Julius the pirate who returned the empire to paganism, rebuked the Neoplatonist philosophers for their luxury in taking baths. You see? So this view is not a law of nature, you know. In fact, right through history, at least our Western history, we should see more of it. And right through our Western history, until England in the 18th century, late 17th century, so far as cleanliness will be regarded as a god, it's exactly reverse of it is. The excessive concern about cleanliness and sanitation was regarded as a sign of suspicion of ungodliness. And yet the American system is not the faintest god. That sanitation and cleanliness are about the high moral virtues and the same kind of gritting of the teeth, the same
impossibility of understanding people like that. I don't know what kind of people are there. See? Now, here's an example of an element of the belief system, the value system, that is not perfectly religious. There are many such rules, and other details when you have the whole belief system. You see what I'm saying here? There are others. I think the high value of popular education. In developed Americans, popular education in developed Americans is not as a utility or whatever, but a moral question. A religious question. A religious moral question. This is not always the case. On the contrary, until the 19th century in America, popular education was regarded as immoral, by and large, immoral and insufficient. A minimum education was necessary for reading, writing, arithmetic, and just enough to read a catechism and make simple calculations. But that's all. So you see, the things we believe as self-evidently true, we add on to what Jefferson regarded as self-evidently true, you know, in the Declaration of Independence. The things we believe as self-evidently true are not, have never been hard to find yet. And they form part of our culture. And of course, to a very degree of Western culture, although a Frenchman laughs at this when he finds an American going mild and indignant over the failure of the hotel to have sufficient bathtubs, or at least the only decent thing to have is a private bathroom. The Frenchman laughs at this kind of thing, you see. And yet, they're civilized people of the West, aren't they? So, you get an idea of what a value system is like. Any questions on this?
Could you just say again when this shift in opinion towards public schooling came about?
The 19th century.
Early
19th century. I have to make a point that Puritans established a common school system there in some common New England. They the country as a whole, the 13 colonies, you know, the states. Only in the 19th century. And then they only again in Massachusetts spread throughout the states. Any questions? Now we have the problem of giving a name to this a context of meaning and value. This operative religion of Americans, in terms of which we can understand self-appraisal. And why does that mean? The American way of life. Now, this is a name that has been given by not so much by journalists, but then also and more recently by sociologists and historians. It's interesting what this American way of life is. For Americans, it supplies the overarching sense of your name is conquered. Speaks about. And the form of there is, after all, we're all Americans. You see that? He said, the overarching sense of your name is conquered. It is that about which Americans are frankly unashamedly empowered. The great mass of Americans who may say they believe in the Trinity, but I've yet to find one who gets all excited about the grossest heresy. They don't get indignant about this. In fact, they don't have enough clarity about what they mean by the phrase to get indignant about anything. You see what I mean? In the American way of life, is that about which Americans are frankly and unashamedly intolerant? And I can take some religious advocates, but also others. And third, is that which really makes a difference in their attitudes and valuations. You see? So, if we go by Robin Williams' concept of a common religion of society, it's the American way of life fulfills that function. Notice the way of life. The phrase, the way of life, is untranslatable in foreign languages. Completely untranslatable. When the French and German editions of my book, Handel, appear, couldn't find a frightful way of life. And therefore they put it in English quotation marks. Way of life.
Is this something that a European equivalent?
And that's interesting and very important. People, different peoples see their coherence different ways. Racial, cultural, as the inheritance of an old culture like French, racial, the way German, but there doesn't be white non white, it means Nordic and non-Nordic. And so on. But Americans are barred, have been barred from all of these definitions of their coherence, shouldn't they? They come from different races, from different cultures, from different everything. And what can they share? A way of life. Therefore, the way of life has become the principle of coherence of Americans. You see what I mean here? And this is not common. There is no, the nearest thing is in England, but there's no place for it.
God save the Queen.
What?
God save the
Queen. Yeah, well, that's right, but that isn't the word way of life. The way the English say is, let's put it this way, that's un-English. That's not critical. That's not forthright, see? It was in some most serious things. About the most serious things. Prison John Salisbury. I go way back. He was a pupil of Peter Abelard, and he wrote the earliest part of the early part of the 13th century. Last about 12th, 35th, 13th century, you know? That's nearly 600 years ago. And he wrote a book, several books on politics, philosophy, and he had a section there defending tyrannicide. Tyrannicide, not telling you how. He defends it, and he gives it the best possible philosophical and scriptural argument, and so on and so forth. It's a law of tradition, it's nothing novel about this. They're discussing the ways in which you can kill a tyrant. And he says all ways, including averaging, all ways are always permissible except one. John Salisbury is one of the Englishmen, although he lost by his best in the American Paris. The one way that's not permissible is poison. Why? He said, it's because we English do not practice it. You see? In other words, it's not English. Or the word is not practice. Do not have anything to do with it. It's underhand, sneaky, you know? This is 100 years ago. And he might have been 20th century Englishman. Saying these foreigners, these Orientals, that can have anything to do with it. Don't listen to it, you see? You're going to be there. But that's the nearest thing you get to the idea of a way of life. But nowhere else does it appear.
Does not your limited in fragmentary aspects in other cultures?
Nope.
Whether it's a self-conscious thing or not, it seems that.
Well, it's kind of a horse. But let's see, it's important here that it should be articulated some way. Look, the Frenchman, they're not going to say, this is the kind of thing a Frenchman will do. Now, in My Fair Lady, there's a line.
Frankly,
I don't care what they say, so long as they say it right.
What do they do?
As long as it's not a problem. That's a French attitude. That's inherent to an old culture. You see? And the French would feel the same kind of violation, the same kind of disgust, as somebody who speaks French raw, as the Americans feel about sanitation. Big difference. We want now to examine this American way of life in its various aspects. And we'll spend some time on it because we are going to examine five aspects: spiritual aspects, ethical aspects, cultural aspects, political economic aspects, and the vision of America. It's why we have a way of life. But before I yes?
Well, actually, then the way you put it, from looking at the whole lecture today, what the Americans should believe, say, as Christians, and what they think they should believe is different, and then what they do believe is still more different.
No, No, what they profess to believe, that's the conventional religion, all right?
Yes, Mr. Swain, what they should believe as Christians, for example, they were really familiar with Christian teaching, they taught their enemies.
Well, that's a professed belief. That's what I call professed belief. Oh, that's professed belief. What they avow as believing is not in line fully with professed belief. All right?
Yes.
All right. It is in line fully, except for a few groups, hold on, we'll come in later, with what I'm going to describe the American way. At the American way. But the American way of professed beliefs, professed religions have a field of overlapping. Don't you see? Both in the American way and in a Christian belief, you ought not to hate a member of another religion. Although I'm thinking of some of the things that were said in the 4th century, the 3rd and 4th century about the Arabs. You ought not to hate somebody of another religion, of another race, of another business. You ought not. On this point, the Christianity and the American way of reaching the right. And it's not an accident, because I'll later on show how the American way emerged out of religious heritage. But I heard that they both agree on whether you want to hate a communist or a Nazi. It had nothing to do with resistance or whether you ought to hate an enemy. On this, the Christianity and the American way differ. And Americans are overwhelmingly about. And their value system in terms of the American way.
Well, what I mean to say then is that Christianity gets watered down what they think they should believe, and they get watered down again what they actually do.
Oh, what they actually do is out of purpose. Only God knows that. I mean, that's so, it's a startling contrast. Those have every culture, every family, all the means, all of God. So it's a startling contrast to what they simply believe they say they believe. And it would take us an infinite amount of time to listen. We're not concerned about it. We're concerned about personal things, see?
I've heard people make the relationship between this period in American life and the period of the prophets in the Old Testament is valid at all. The fact of the culture being completely out of line with what should be held politically.
No, it's not in line completely. What happens when the what the prophet was announcing was referencing to the covenant. And that took the form of the Hebrews on the other land of Canaan adapted a Canaanite religion for not for their religious purposes, but for everyday purposes, for agriculture. And that was the prophet announced, I'm saying. This bears no relation to what we're talking about because we didn't adopt the heathenish ways of the American Indians when we came here. See, that would be equivalent. It bears no relation. Every age wants to see itself as an age of prophets. But God calls us prophets when he pleases him. Now, we want to examine in detail what this American way is, because out of this, and only out of this, can we understand American religion. Notice that I pointed out there's an overlapping freedom. There are many values that I know both in the Christian tradition of thought and the American way. Many values. But there are others where they diverge. Now, first, let's examine the content of the American way. Spiritual. I said five aspects, the spiritual aspect, the ethical aspect, the cultural aspect, the political and economic aspect, and the vision of America. Let's take the spiritual aspect first. Obviously, the first belief of Americans, I think I might get a quotation for this, the first belief of Americans is the first element of the American way on a spiritual level is belief in the Supreme Being. I want to get a quotation here if I can find it. It'll take a moment here and I'll find it. Here. It's a passage from President Eisenhower's statement, a statement of President Eisenhower in 1955. And this could be repeated from other sources. Without God, there could be no American common government, nor any American way of life. Recognition of the Supreme Being is the first, the most basic expression of what?
American.
Of Americanism. Not of religion, which is really causal. Although the obvious, but of Americans. I don't think that one American out of a thousand who would even pause at this point. That's obvious. The belief in God, recognition of a Supreme Being, I think, works for being in the most Christian way. Believe in God, recognition of a Supreme Being, and is universally held as the first, as the cornerstone of the American way. Justice Douglas, I think, I'm not thinking of Justice Douglas, in the Zorak case, 1952. We are a religious people whose institutions presuppose the Supreme Being. Say Supreme Being.
Okay.
Pops up in both places, you see? Just take the word that you could get a million pieces of documentation if you go out of the way to look for it. But it's not necessary. I don't think anybody in his right mind is going to question that. That is a cornerstone. That's obviously both a part of the religious tradition and a part of the American way. There they overlap very soon, obviously. Is that clear? Secondly, idealism. America is one of the most idealistic people in the world, by which I mean that they will never, whatever they do, they will never avow in their own conviction simple, obvious motives of self-interest. They will always obsessively idealize what they're doing. I'll illustrate this in a moment. And that, incidentally, that has a tremendous consequences. Let me read a passage through here. One is from Woodrow Wilson. Sometimes people call me an idealist. Well, that's how I know I'm an American. America's the most idealistic nation in the world. Another one from, I just came across from Gilda Chesterton, D.K. Chesterton, the English writer, in a book called The Green Man. And they're talking about somebody. It's a very apt quotation. He has lived in the States, but in the United States. He has lived in the States. But somehow I never remember it when he's talking about dollars, because he's talking about America, talking about dollars. Only when he's talking about ideals. There is no harm in having ambitions. But he had ambitions that called him ideals. Any perceptive European recognizes the characteristics of America. They're fantastically idealistic. I have an article here from, if you're not concerned, but it's by B.F. Hitmark, who's the correspondent. This article here, the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, that is in Zurich, in Switzerland. And he wants to correct the impressions that some Europeans have of America, that they're materialistic, that they're dollar mad, and so on. He says this is quite untrue. And on the contrary, he says, the problem that Americans are, what you might call, understated, compulsively idealistic. Whoever interprets American foreign policy in terms of economic interest or imperial power does not understand that it springs from sincere conviction rooted in the Puritan inheritance. There he goes on. In its broader outline, American foreign policy is governed by idealistic convictions that seeks moral goals. That is, to me, that's not a phrase, that's a criticism. To him too, because nothing can confuse foreign policy more than anything for taking abstract moral principles. And he goes on. But no American believes that. American believes that foreign policy is moral and it's wicked. And only the Europeans practice wicked policy of foreign policy. Americans have yet to learn that idealism, even when pursued with crazy missionary zeal, leads only to trouble. That's what he says. For while the school of people lead ideals at bottom, they do not always want to achieve them, especially under duress. The idealistic approach to foreign policy of the people who are assumed to be hard-headed businessmen is one of the most important reasons for serious misunderstandings in Europe and America. One need only open an American newspaper to discover that prominent commentators are apparently convinced that it would be possible to deal with the subject that are purely business-like, but that's not a question I'll take on a little later. You see the point here? In only America, and by exporting from America, do businessmen have to pretend they're performing a service to the universe? What are those businessmen called in America? Service clubs. In every other part of the world, a businessman is in business. In America, he's in service. You see that? He wouldn't feel right if he weren't, if he didn't think himself performing a service for the universe. You are merely a businessman. Americans never feel right at being crude, materialistic, and power makers.
Maintained by American, half American product of gifts.
Columbia. They were class. They had a class. They had a staff. They're getting a spaceship. This is so familiar to us that we don't realize how hard it is. And how a particular pattern of culture emerged out of this. Is that clear, the point I'm making here? I guess.
Yes,
the special optimism, not special optimism. Special optimism. Not only American ideals, but surely ideals must conquer what's good must win. It's self-evident. Whereas the whole burden of Christian tradition is the reverse. What's good must always fail. No, it's not related to any philosophy. Philosophical ideals, in fact, we have known in America. It came out later on, Roy and St. Louis there, and the Hegelians, a group of German, Germans, and the Harris of America. But unimportant in America. It's not related to any system of philosophy. And incidentally, philosophical idealism doesn't have to end up in our idealism. The term is equivalent, you know. Not good enough. The word doesn't mean the same thing. In moral idealism and philosophical idealism. Although there's a historical connection, perhaps even more, but it doesn't mean the same thing. Now, any other questions? Now, the third feature is moralism. Everything is moralized in America. Every public activity comes to crusade. No country in the world has so many crusades in America. In the Second World War, I'm not a crusade. Remember, that was called Second Crusade or something. But Wilson had already called this the First World War Crusade. And I now call 1952 elections a crusade. And every American calls anything that takes seriously as a crusade. America's moralized everything. It's always accomplished with good and evil. And they're always engaged in some kind of crusade. Crusade prohibition, the crusade against bingo, the crusade against this, and the crusade for that. They're always crusading. America wouldn't feel wrong to be going to gain the moral crusade. Again, it's so obvious, you must have heard it 100 times. It's so obvious, I don't even explain to this. This is unusual. And again, we have some connection later, that way. But the continent, nobody ever heard of such nonsense. Nobody ever heard of it. Whatever they do, they do for reasons or unreasons or something, but nobody thinks of it as a moral crusade, you know. Now, the fourth feature, again, the spiritual aspect, is the supreme value of the individual. This is so characteristic of American outlook, the American way, that everyone understands this. We'll see that in some incoming religious heritage. All the others have a religious heritage. Curious how the religious heritage formed the American way of life, and the American way of life supplanted the religious heritage. Well, and it's not so curious after all. And the fifth element of the American way of life on the spiritual side is brotherhood, which is the thing that's settled by the four. Brotherhood. But what brotherhood means to Americans is something not obvious. It means the brotherhood of all Americans. Americans will help the most distant peoples whom they never heard of, whom they have only slight for, of their idealism. They're good doing. But when they think of brotherhood, it always is under the formula, the official formula, after all Americans. Not the formula, the brotherhood.
Always ideal. Aren't they spread throughout all the other?
Aren't they what?
Aren't they spread throughout
other countries?
Brotherhood?
More of them. Well, England is the nearest thing, but you will never have a brotherhood movement in France or Germany. In fact, it failed.
Most of the
adults
of the child, many of the children throughout all cultures, have to serve some ideal attitude.
Yes, you do. The family the discipline is under the German of children. You obey your father, and you should be seen, not heard. These are standards. They're hardly American ideal standards, idealistic standards. Of course you have, but not American idealistic standards. inquired about, most struck by this very difference. Italians, Germans, French, middle class Frenchmen, not bad Frenchmen.
Well,
peasants as well. Huh, they all come to the country, just happy they're not struck by it. But they're all struck by this difference.
Now, does this mean that those people who Americans consider to be foreign, who live in their midst, are not their brothers?
Well, yes, they're not their brothers, but they're the object of their charity, for their idealism. You see? And their brothers are part of their Americans. But they're not. They don't think that they just treat them otherwise, you see?
No.
They don't feel it communally. On the contrary, they're more lavish to the others in their good doing than they are to their brothers. And America was conquered more promptly to a earthquake in Japan than to Southern Africa, Colorado. Why? Because what does Washington take care of? You see? It's a disaster area. We have a special relation with this. It's a disaster area.